We'll proceed next in the matter of People v. Jarmal Arand Smith.
Stay tuned for the AOC's live broadcast beginning shortly. Please stay tuned for the AOC's live broadcast beginning shortly. Please stay tuned for the AOC's live broadcast beginning shortly. Please stay tuned for the AOC's live broadcast beginning shortly. Please stay tuned for the AOC's live broadcast beginning shortly. Please stay tuned for the AOC's live broadcast beginning shortly. Please stay tuned for the AOC's live broadcast beginning shortly. Please stay tuned for the AOC's live broadcast beginning shortly. Please stay tuned for the AOC's live broadcast beginning shortly. Please stay tuned for the AOC's live broadcast beginning shortly. Please stay tuned for the AOC's live broadcast beginning shortly. Please stay tuned for the AOC's live broadcast beginning shortly. Please stay tuned for the AOC's live broadcast beginning shortly. Please stay tuned for the AOC's live broadcast beginning shortly. Please stay tuned for the AOC's live broadcast beginning shortly. Please Please stay tuned for the AOC's live broadcast beginning shortly. Please stay tuned for the AOC's live broadcast beginning shortly.
We'll proceed now in the matter of People versus Jamal Lavon Smith, and we're very pleased to have sitting with us by assignment the Honorable Roger Boren, the Administrative Presiding Justice of the Second Appellate District, sitting by assignment as a Justice Pro Tem of our court. We will hear first from Mr. Marshall.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court, Gregory Marshall appearing on behalf of the petitioner, Jamal Smith. This case presents a single, very narrow issue, namely when Mr. Smith fired a single bullet at the departing car of his girlfriend, or his ex-girlfriend, was he liable for one count or two counts of attempted murder?
Is it relevant to what extent he knew that there was a baby in the car seat? And the evidence does indicate that he was aware that there was a second person, namely the infant. There.
Your Honor, I believe that's the key thing that the Court of Appeal relied on, I think, by way of citing the Chinchilla opinion. And
my question is basically, you know, what is the legal significance of his awareness that there was an infant in the vehicle? Obviously, you can have a situation where somebody's totally unaware, and that would obviously have substantial relevance to the question underway here.
Well, I think as a technical matter, I'd be reluctant to say it's irrelevant, but it's not of much significance at all. And that's because we're dealing with an attempt crime here, and particularly in the context of murder, it's a little bit of an oddity because you can be found guilty of murder without intending to kill anyone, but you can't be found guilty of attempted murder without specific intent to kill that individual.
So your position is basically, just to follow up, that had the infant been killed, let's say the infant and the mother been killed, that a single shot could support both convictions of murder, but given the specific intent required for an attempt, that the defendant could not be found guilty of attempting the murder of both the woman driver and the infant. Is that a correct statement of your position?
Offhand, maybe I'm drawing a blank, Your Honor, but offhand, I can't think of he could have been guilty of a second, less than first degree murder with respect to the baby. That's correct. Not a first degree murder, however, not that I can think of.
Mr. Marshall, you made the statement that to be guilty of an attempt, the accused must have had the specific intent to kill the individual.
Correct.
Now, in this case, the jury found your client guilty of two counts of attempted murder. Am I correct?
That's correct.
What were the instructions given the jury? Were they instructed that in order to find an attempted murder, the defendant must have intended to kill each of the two?
They were, as far as I know, they were given the conventional instructions, so that I don't recall specifically at this moment, but it's my belief that they were so instructed.
And so the traditional instructions, you say, would include the concept of intent.
Correct.
So in essence, you're asking us to make a finding of law contrary to the finding of fact the jury made?
I think that's a fair characterization. That's correct.
In that connection, maybe true.
Well, I was just going to say, so you're really arguing that substantial evidence doesn't support what the jury impliedly found.
That's correct. It's a circumstantial inference in almost all cases having to do with determining a defendant's intent. And I believe the essential meaning of the Bland case, which I rely on, in this circumstance, is essentially a rule of law that there is some threshold requirement of evidence for that circumstantial inference to be drawn.
So, just to make sure we understand the background here, there's no contention at all that the jury was not properly instructed as to the necessity of finding intent to kill as to the bait.
I haven't made that argument, although I suppose it's implied in my argument that the jury should have been instructed or might well have been instructed more specifically on the language of the under the language of the Bland case.
But they were certainly instructed as to the elements of attempted murder, which include intent to kill.
That's correct.
And is it also correct that there was no specific instruction that dealt with the concept of kill zone?
That's also correct.
So the only question we have is whether on appeal, whether the Court of Appeal may or may not have misutilized the kill zone theory to support the conviction of attempted murder as to the baby.
Yes, that, I think that's
so. Isn't the real issue here whether the jury could reasonably conclude that the defendant intended to kill the baby when the defendant fired the weapon through the back seat, through the back window of the car, and the baby was in the direct line of fire with the mother? Isn't that the critical issue? Could a jury reasonably conclude that the defendant intended to kill both the baby and the mother by firing that weapon the way it was fired?
Well, the answer to that, my answer to that, Your Honor, is yes, but. Again, getting on the subject of jury instructions, the jury was not made aware of the Bland, the rule, as I see it, of Bland. But additionally, if the jury had been and had gone ahead and found Mr. Smith guilty of that second count of attempted murder, we would still be, or at least that would certainly be argued on appeal.
But there's no issue before us as to the instructions to the jury. The only issue before us is whether there was sufficient evidence to support the jury's determination that when the defendant fired the weapon, he intended to kill both the baby and the mother.
That's correct, Your Honor. And my argument is predicated on this court's Bland opinion, which, as I read it, or as I contend, sets a threshold for the evidence, which was not crossed in this case. And therefore,
Mr. Marshall, you indicated at the outset that this was a single-shot case.
Correct.
But didn't the facts show that the police found two casings in the defendant's room? And didn't the defendant say that, I believe he heard two shots fired? So why couldn't the jury find that two shots were fired rather than one? And if it did, how would that change your argument?
I would say that there was not sufficient evidence by any means to hold Mr. Smith liable for having fired two shots. His testimony was, not unusually for a criminal defendant, his testimony was a completely different version. He, as I recall it, he heard a shot fired and he hit the ground or something of that nature, and then subsequently indicating that there was some short passage of time, then he heard other shots. Oftentimes, juries reject defendants' arguments, and they certainly did reject his argument in this case in its larger sense, in the sense that I didn't do it. And I think it would be inappropriate to find sufficient evidence to find him guilty of firing two shots based on his version of the event, which the jury rejected.
And what about the physical evidence of the two casings?
Well, the two casings were in his bedroom, and that's quite an extent, and this is at some remove in time also. I think that's quite an extension to get from this scene. The one thing we know about the scene is that there's only clear evidence of one shot being fired.
Counselor, can you reconcile Chinchilla with Bland, or how would you distinguish the two, and in which case are you relying upon?
Well, I'm definitely relying on Bland, and that's my essential point, is that Chinchilla can't be reconciled with Bland.
So you think it has to be disapproved?
That's correct.
Well, is that necessarily true? In Chinchilla, as I understand the facts, the defendant, as this defendant, supposedly fired one bullet.
Correct.
But in Chinchilla, there were two policemen, one crouched behind the other. So could he not, in that circumstance, have intended to kill both policemen?
Perhaps I overstated my case in my answer to Justice Moreno. I think that certainly Chinchilla should be distinguished on these facts.
Now, as I understand the facts in this case, the baby is in a baby car seat facing toward the rear window, and the mother's in the driver's seat.
That's my understanding.
We have a photograph in the record, and the car seat is below the headrest of the mother's front seat.
Correct.
And as we know, a three-month-old baby's head does not extend above the back of the baby car seat, so the baby is down. The bullet went through the headrest of the...
On the driver's side.
So this is factually distinguishable from Chinchilla.
Absolutely.
Because, that bullet directed at the mother's head would not in any way necessarily endanger the baby.
That's correct. And one of the arguments that the Attorney General has raised is that, well, there was glass on the baby, and so that could have caused damage. Or another argument, I believe, was that perhaps if the bullet had struck the mother who was driving, then the baby could be injured or killed in a car crash. But those things get beyond any question of the intent displayed by Mr. Smith's act. And again, we have to focus on his intent because we're talking about an attempted
murder. So your position is that one bullet fired at the height of the driver's head does not allow the inference of an intent to kill a three-month-old baby who is below that, who's positioned below that headrest.
That's certainly true.
Now, let me ask you this to further explore the area of concurrent intent or the kill zone theory as a follow-up to Justice Werdiger's questions. Let's just say instead of firing a single shot into the vehicle, the defendant had thrown a grenade into the vehicle and miraculously both the mother and the child survived. Would your answers be the same or would they be different in terms of specific intent and the killing of or attempt to kill both individuals, even though it would again be one single missile entering
Correct.
The vehicle?
And I suppose the argument could be made, but under the state of the law as it is, that argument is not, it's just simply incorrect. In fact, he would have been liable for three counts because there was also the new boyfriend in the car. There would have been three people. In fact, that case gets closer to the facts of Bland, where Bland involved two gangster types both with firearms firing who knows how many shots into a vehicle with three individuals, killing one and wounding both of them.
So you can have a situation where although the animus is focused upon one particular individual, due to the means employed, there's basically an intent that can be assumed to kill everyone in the immediate vicinity.
That's correct.
Absolutely. Obviously, if you put a bomb on a plane, you know that everybody is going to suffer the same fate as the one individual you may have in mind.
That's right. In Bland, this court quoted at some length from a case called Ford versus State, I think, a Maryland case. And there are three examples the Ford court used, and Your Honor, you just referred to two of them. The bomb on the plane and the explosive device, and then the third one was the hail of bullets. I'm not sure that was the court's exact language, but that was the sense of it, the hail of bullets, the fusillade of bullets. And those were the illustrations the Ford court used, which this court cited with apparent approval in Bland as the kill, quote-unquote, kill zone facts.
Let me give you another hypothetical. What if you have one shot hits the gas tank, car explodes, three people in the car survive. Three attempts or one?
I would say one, Your Honor.
One. Is it different if you aimed at the gas tank or if you just happened to hit the gas tank?
That becomes a difficult evidentiary problem in that hypothetical. But assuming there is some reason in the evidence to believe the defendant had an intent to hit the gas tank, I think that probably would cross that threshold.
Well, let me just one more hypothetical. Say there's four passengers in the car, and the defendant shoots out two tires. How many counts of attempted murder?
That's a I'd have to think about that one, Your Honor. Probably, I would say under the kill zone, at least certainly I can see a much stronger argument under the kill zone theory, again, assuming that this is intentionally shooting out the tires, I can certainly see the argument that there would be four counts because the defendant has created something that falls within that kill zone definition.
But this, of course, is not your case.
That's so correct. I would count, I'm glad
just
to stress that.
Just to clarify the facts, you're not suggesting that the defendant was not aware that the child was in the car seat, are you?
No, I'm not suggesting that.
You're not suggesting that. And you're not suggesting that simply because the defendant may not have been a marksman, in other words, although it may have been conceivable that had he been a marksman and had the car not been moving, that it was technically possible to kill the mother without killing the child, that that does not preclude a jury from reasonably concluding that when he fired the .38 caliber revolver at the mother, that the jury could not reasonably conclude that he intended to kill both.
I think my argument is that the jury could not reasonably draw that conclusion on these facts. The bullet, there's only one shot fired, and it's the
what
track of the bullet.
What if the child was hit and injured, but not the mother? Then what crime has been committed against the child?
That's another thing that I think that I know is mentioned in Bland. I think this is independent of the Ford case. I think this was this court's own language in Bland, that the defendant definitely could be guilty of an assault on the baby, for example. In that case, the defendant could be held guilty of attempted murder of the mother, assuming he's shooting at the mother but hits the baby.
Well, why do we have juries? In other words, isn't this a perfect example of where a jury considers all the facts and circumstances, considers the question of whether the defendant was in, whether the baby was in the line of fire, considers all those factors, and then makes a decision, properly instructed, that under the facts of this case, we conclude that when the defendant fired the shot, he intended to kill both. I mean, why do we have juries if they don't have the authority to make those factual determinations?
My answer to that, it harkens back to some of the questions the court answered from the audience earlier today. It has to do with why we have courts and why we have levels of appellate review, because it is the courts, as Justice Marshall said, it's the province of the judicial department to say what the law is. And I believe in Bland, and correctly, this court set a kind of threshold which below which, if the evidence falls below that threshold, no jury can be allowed to return a guilty verdict.
Suppose the mother is holding the baby as a shield, and the defendant says, "I want to kill you, mother," and fires the shot. And let's say that they're both injured, or he misses. Could a reasonable jury, under those circumstances, conclude that the defendant intended to kill both the baby and the mother, or is his statement that he only intended to kill the mother binding on that jury?
Although your time is up, you may respond to Justice.
Very well. If I could just, there are two parts to my response. I think that the hypothetical you just gave, Justice Baxter, is the one that definitely brings us above what I see as that threshold to where this is an inference the jury can properly draw. It also calls to mind the distinction that Justice Werdiger made about the facts of the Chinchilla case with the two police officers. The facts you just hypothesized would make my position much more difficult because of essentially getting back to the idea of a kill zone. You've hypothesized a situation where one bullet there's such a probability that one bullet could kill both individuals that I think the kill zone rationale, at least arguably, could apply there where I argue it can't apply here.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Marshall. We'll hear now from Ms. Newcomb.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Rochelle Newcomb on behalf of Respondent. The appellant in this case defined the issue as whether or not a single shot could provide liability for two counts of attempted murder. However, it is our position that Justice Baxter actually stated the real issue in this case, which is whether or not the jury could reasonably conclude on the facts of this case that appellant, in attempting to kill his primary victim, actually created a kill zone which extended out his intent under a concurrent intent theory to the baby as well.
Before you go any further, it's just to clear up some confusion. As I was listening to the questions from the bench and the responses that Mr. Marshall gave, at one point the inquiry pertained to two casings that were found. I would like to hear from you whether you are relying on the argument that instead of one single bullet, two bullets were fired.
In our case, Your Honor, our position is that the defendant is liable for two counts of attempted murder, regardless of whether there was one bullet or two fired in this case. There is evidence.
Leaving the legal issue aside, I am asking for a clarification of the factual evidence here. Questions focused on the finding of two casings in the defendant's bedroom. You may recall that Mr. Marshall, in responding to the question, pointed out, well, but those two casings were found not at the scene of the actual shooting, but in the bedroom. As I recall, the prosecutor's theory was there was one bullet. And listening to how you started your argument, you talked about one single bullet. I presume you are distancing yourself from any assumption that here two shots were fired at the scene.
There is testimony in the record of both. There's testimony from the victim, Ms. Anderson, as well as from the father that there were one shot fired. There was testimony from the defendant that there were three shots fired, actually.
Right.
However,
the argument or the reliance about more than one shot being fired is really based entirely on the defendant's testimony. And I would like to hear from you, and I would like you to go on after this, but I need the clarification. I presume that you agree with the prosecution's theory that, as he said, one shot rather than three. One shot, one shot, one shot. I presume the Attorney General on appeal is sticking with the prosecutor's theory of one shot fired.
To answer your question directly, Your Honor, our position on appeal is that the prosecution's theory is correct. However, it is the province of the jury to determine the facts of this case. If for some reason this court were to conclude that two shots had to have been fired in order for there to be liability, then it would still be acceptable for the jury to have evaluated the evidence and determined that more than one bullet was fired in order to reach their conclusion. It is our position that a single bullet was sufficient under Bland and as this court's precedent to find defendant guilty of both counts. However, if this court were to find otherwise and to say that two bullets had to have been fired, there is sufficient evidence in the record of that from the defendant's testimony, from which the jury could conclude that he was credible on that fact.
How much later, after the incident itself, the shooting, was it that the authorities found the two casings at the defendant's residence?
I'm trying to remember, Your Honor. I believe it was later in the day. According to the defendant himself, he claimed that he picked up the two bullet casings at the scene of the crime. He found them on the ground, according to him. And then he went to his mother's after the crime, and I believe the police searched the residence that evening. I'm not certain, but I believe that's what happened. So it was several hours later, at the least. I can get back to the court on that if necessary.
Why is it even necessary to get into the kill zone theory? First of all, the jury was not instructed on kill zone, I don't think.
No, Your Honor.
The jury was properly instructed on the elements of attempted murder, so the jury knew, based on the instructions, that in order for them to find the defendant guilty of attempted murder of the baby, they would have to find that the defendant intended to kill the baby. Now, based on the evidence and on appeal, we have to interpret that evidence in a manner most favorable to the prosecution. And interpreting that evidence most favorable to the prosecution, we have a defendant who knows the baby's in the baby seat, who fires a .38 caliber weapon at least once, and the baby's in the line of fire. Now, the question, it seems to me, is simply, could a jury reasonably conclude, based on that evidence, that the defendant intended to kill both the baby and the mother, without regard to kill zone and without regard to Bland and all of these other theories? So my question to you is, why is it even necessary to rely on a kill zone theory? I mean, I think it's different from, let's say, the President Kennedy assassination, where at least under some theory, that single shot ricocheted and ended up hitting the governor of Texas and injuring him, and then the question of whether that would constitute an attempted murder. Here we have something very different. We have both the mother and the baby in the direct line of fire. It's almost the same as if the mother was shooting the baby. So I guess my question is,
a result of the passage of time and the emergence,
get to the question of kill zone in this case.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court in Bland, which, by the way, was decided in 2002, and this case, the instant case, was submitted to the jury in 2000, so that might be why there was some questioning about the instruction. But with regard to your question on the kill zone, in Bland, this court stated that there have been several cases that have found basically a concurrent intent theory or kill zone theory without the benefit of the decision in Bland calling it kill zone. And whether or not we call it kill zone here and use Bland's language to find concurrent intent, I agree with Your Honor that it is clearly an intent to kill case. The jury was instructed on intent to kill simply because the defendant had a direct fire at the baby, within inches of the baby's head. He was only a few feet away from the car when he fired his weapon. All of those factors demonstrate his intent to kill, which is proven by circumstantial evidence.
Is that relevant, though?
Couldn't one argue that the factors demonstrate a reckless disregard for the well-being of the baby or implied malice?
No, Your Honor. In this case, we would say they may also prove that if he had killed the baby. I guess there was a theory for that. However, in this case, it's very clear that it was an intent to kill.
He knew the baby was where the baby was, and I have a photograph as to how that was positioned. Knowledge translates, in your argument, to he specifically intended to kill the baby?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe knowledge is necessary.
Then what else is there?
There's a totality of factors here, the means and manner of attack, for example.
So that's the kill zone.
That is how the court defined it in Bland, yes. But that doesn't.
Justice Baxter was saying we don't have to go to kill zone. You can infer specific intent to kill the baby because he knew the baby was there.
There are. Whether you call it kills or not, Your Honor, you're looking at all of the factors, and the factors include that the baby was in the direct line of fire. The factors include the type of weapon he used. The factors include the positioning of the defendant from his victims and the victims to each other, how close they were in the mother's arms or in a car seat behind her, which is inches away.
Do the circumstances also include whatever expression of animus there was or was not with regard to the mother and the child, respectively? And we have testimony in the record that indicates the day before the incident there was a telephone conversation, and the defendant told Karen that the next time he saw her he would slap her, using somewhat more colorful language. And then actually on the day of the event, he addressed her in a hostile way as well. There's no indication, as one might have in another factual scenario, where I'm going to get you and your baby or anything like that. That would be a much easier case for you. Was there any expression on behalf of the defendant vis-a-vis the baby and the defendant's intent toward the baby?
There is no expression of intent in this case in terms of verbal expression, as we're talking about, towards the baby. He did have animus towards the mother, and clearly, as well, there's evidence towards the front seat passenger in the sense of other evident physical altercation taking place and so forth. And that might further answer Justice Werdiger's question, which goes to the intent to kill versus conscious disregard for life. Had there been no expression, these were just people that randomly were driving through the neighborhood and he shot at the car and killed them, we might have a different case in the sense of conscious disregard for life, because there would be a question of did he have intent to kill a particular person in the car, what have you. In this case, it's clear that he had a primary victim, the mother in this case, that he was aiming towards. He had an intent to kill towards her.
Counsel, is it your position that a conviction for attempted murder could have been sustained as to the adult passenger against whom he had expressed some animus?
Had that been charged in this case?
Yes.
Certainly.
And under what theory that he's...
Well, in that case, let me back up a second. In that case, you'd have to look, again, at the totality of circumstances, and the bullet was fired directly at the mother.
How do we know that? How do we know the car is moving, he's shooting? There's no way of telling, he is a sufficient marksman to pinpoint the actual driver of the car. I mean, the bullet went through the rear window. Why couldn't one argue that he's shooting at the other adult passenger?
Of course, that could be argued as well. It depends upon the totality of the circumstances, and the jury would be presented with all of that evidence, and the jury would then have to conclude, was that single bullet fired in the trajectory with which it took, and the defendant's distance, and all of those things calculated to determine whether sufficient evidence supported three counts of attempted murder had that been charged.
You're not saying that as a condition of an attempted murder conviction, the bullet has to come within a certain distance, inches or feet, from one of the victims?
No. There's no specific number of inches or feet. It's simply looking at all of the factors to determine whether or not concurrent intent was demonstrated to means and manner of attack, is the language used.
Well, you have three passengers and one bullet, and we're assuming the individual is not a good marksman. Do you have three counts of attempted murder?
Again, you'd have to look at all the factors. In one of the cases cited in my brief, State versus Sharp, there is a case where there's two officers standing shoulder to shoulder, and there's a bullet fired. Now, assuming the bullet is fired directly, and it was fired directly at the mid-chest, they found attempted murder for both of those officers, even though they were shoulder to shoulder and not front and back like the baby and mother were in this case.
That's not a California case.
It is not. But they did find that case also demonstrated the concurrent intent theory of liability. And the closeness of the officers to each other, the closeness of the defendant to them, demonstrated his intent. Now, again, we're talking a matter of inches. Now, you could say, well, he couldn't possibly kill them both if they're standing side by side. But the question is, the defendant clearly wanted to kill his intended victim and would do whatever it took to do that.
If you had a vehicle containing six passengers and one shot was fired, would your position be that because you could have killed any of the six people, or maybe more than one, that the six counts would be permissible?
We think, Your Honor, that this theory could be stretched too far. You would have to look at the totality of the circumstances. And in that case, I think if you've got six people and they're sitting in different places in the car, it sort of depends on where the defendant was firing from, the positioning of those people in the car. They are close together. There is a good question. I mean, for example, aiming at the driver of that car could disable the car. And if he was basically saying, this car is full of gang members that I'd like to take out, I only got one bullet, I think I'll fire at the driver, and the driver's going by quickly. My best shot to get everybody is to kill the driver or to hit the gas tank, which was another example given in this case. Again, you'd have to look at the totality of circumstances. In that case, if the single bullet had been fired at the driver with the intention of causing the vehicle to crash, or at the gas tank with the intention of causing the car to explode, you could have six counts of attempted murder. That's part of the kill zone theory, is looking at that. What means did he use in order to effectuate his primary intent and kill his primary victim?
But in this case, there was a passenger in the front seat, and there had been words exchanged between that passenger and the defendant. But nevertheless, there was no attempt by the prosecution in this case to establish an attempted murder as to that passenger. Is that correct?
Well, actually, to be clear on the facts, the prosecutor did have the front seat passenger charged, as well as the mother initially. At the close of evidence, the prosecutor attempted to amend and add a third count, including the baby. However, at that time, the judge denied that as untimely. So when the prosecutor then moved to amend the complaint to have the baby instead of the front seat passenger charged. So there was an attempt to have all three charged. However, ultimately, it was just the mother and the baby who were charged victims.
Well, the adult passenger was an uncooperative witness, wasn't he?
You could say that.
He declined to identify the defendant.
He did.
Because he thought he would be labeled a snitch.
Correct.
And the baby would be a much more sympathetic victim.
Well, there's always that theory, Your Honor. However, there's also the fact that the evidence supported the direct line of fire, which is why I believe the prosecutor moved to amend the information at that point.
Well, let's suppose that there had been no animus expressed in the case. In other words, let's just assume that the defendant had never exchanged words with anybody. And all the evidence shows is that a defendant fires through the back windshield of a car, and the bullet nearly hits the baby and the mother. Let's say they're seated in the same position. Would a jury under those circumstances be precluded from convicting on any count of attempted murder simply because there was no animus expressed beforehand?
It would be a much closer case. It would be difficult to present the intent to kill part of the case. It would be difficult for the prosecutor to present that. They would have it all presented by the circumstantial evidence of the defendant's firing, et cetera. That doesn't mean it's precluded. It would simply be a more difficult case.
But isn't that exactly what juries are for? In other words, some people would take the view that actions speak louder than words. And just looking at the action involved, the firing of the weapon, et cetera, doesn't make any difference if he said anything. And on the other hand, the jury might conclude to the contrary, that, you know, based on these facts, we're not convinced that beyond a reasonable doubt that there was an intent to kill. So I guess my point is that it's really a question of what the jury determines and whether there's substantial evidence to support the finding.
Correct, Your Honor. Yes, sufficiency of the evidence. The province of this court is simply to determine whether or not the trier of fact reasonably conclude, based upon the evidence, that there was sufficient evidence of intent to kill. And it would be up to the jury to make that conclusion.
Well, if this were a situation in which there were six individuals in a vehicle and a single shot was fired, there was no indication that the driver was targeted, no indication that the tires or the gas tank were targeted just at one shot, was fired into a vehicle with six occupants. And the prosecutor was ambitious enough to charge six counts of attempted murder, and the jury found the defendant guilty of six counts of attempted murder. Would it be our obligation, under your theory that you've put forth in the last couple of responses, to uphold all six convictions?
If this court looked at all the evidence, viewed the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, and were basically to come to the conclusion that there's no reasonable jury could objectively conclude that that was true, then this court would have to overturn that case. However, there would be a lot of factors that the court would have to look at, all the evidence presented to the jury, and to make the conclusion whether or not the jury simply was outside the province of the jury to make such a conclusion based upon those facts. That's possible, but I would say it's a high standard. And if the prosecutor was able to prove to that jury, based upon all the circumstances, that he was liable for six counts of attempted murder.
Based upon what? Assuming that we're talking about attempted murders, I presume you would acknowledge that for attempted murder, there has to be actual intent.
Correct, Your Honor.
And I was just waiting to hear that particular term coming from your part of the response to the Chief Justice, but you would agree actual intent.
Definitely, in
taking
all of these
you
cases.
To this particular case, yes, the prosecution won in the trial court. The prosecution got two convictions of attempted murder. Now, we know attempted murder requires an actual intent. So then we take a look at the facts in this particular case. As has been pointed out earlier, here the mother drove up with the baby, to drop the baby off at the house of the father, her new boyfriend. Defendant, her former boyfriend, saw her park at the curb. He came up to the car and then said, "The next time I see you, I'm going to do blah, blah, blah to you." Quite a threat. And then heated words were exchanged between the new boyfriend and defendant. The mother drove off. As she drove off, the defendant shot or fired one shot through the car. The question is, leaving aside the attempted murder conviction of the mother, I don't think there's any dispute that that was proper. We are dealing with whether the conviction of attempted murder of the baby was proper. You earlier acknowledged actual intent is necessary for attempted murder. How or where do you find that actual intent that when the defendant fired that shot from the back of where he was standing into the car as the mother drove off with the baby, that the defendant had the actual intent to kill the baby?
You infer that fact from all of the circumstances in the case. You look at the fact, for example, that the defendant, as you noted, came up and had a confrontation with the mother prior to...
He threatened her. And correct. You may recall that at an earlier point, Justice Werdiger, when Mr. Marshall was at the podium, pointed out that based upon the exhibits that this court has and has looked at, the baby seat that was in the back of the car was below the line of view, I think, of the defendant, or may have just stuck out a wee bit. Is it your view that the defendant actually knew that when he fired that shot into the back of the car, the baby would get killed?
Yes, Your Honor. It's our position that the defendant had the specific intent to kill whoever was in his way in order to get to the mother. Had he wanted to kill only the mother, he had every opportunity to do so when he first confronted her.
Well, about the contention, the argument that I presume the opposing side could make? Looking at the photographs that this court has, those photographs show that the top of the baby seat was just to the bottom of the driver's headrest. And that was just a few inches below the point where the defendant's bullet hit the headrest. So where do you, from what you infer, the actual intent to kill the baby given this particular factual circumstance?
Again, looking at all of the circumstances, the means of attack that he used, the closeness of the defendant to his victims, the fact that he would have taken any measure he needed to ensure the mother's death.
But even with the baby, the mother, I'm going to beat you up the next time I see you. He never said, and I'm going not only to get you, I'm going to kill that baby.
A lot of times we do not have evidence of direct evidence of the defendant's statement of animus towards a particular victim. That doesn't thereby negate the fact that he's willing to kill that victim in order to get to his primary victim. Simply because he didn't say, I want to kill the baby or I'll kill anybody just to make sure I kill you, doesn't mean that there isn't circumstantial evidence of that intent by the fact that he fired and aimed and fired his weapon from the distance he did at the victims that were that close in proximity. I think in a lot of ways this case is indistinguishable from Chinchilla in the sense that in Chinchilla the officers were right.
Now that you mentioned the Chinchilla case by the Court of Appeal, you may recall that in that particular case, as the defendant fired the shot at the officer, behind that officer, crouching behind that officer, was another officer. I think this case is different, again, because as Justice Werdiger pointed out earlier, the baby seat was not, the baby was not visible from where the defendant was firing the shot at the mother at that grammar, but you get my meaning. In the Chinchilla case, it was different. There, when the defendant pointed his gun at the officer, there was another officer crouching behind the other officer.
However, in that case, Your Honor, in Chinchilla, the court did not say, well, he fired just over the officer in behind's head, and he was a few inches above his head. Therefore, he could only have aimed for the officer who was a little bit higher. The court did not say, we're going to parse it out to such a degree that he's only liable for the one he was closest to hit. That would limit this case to a number of inches or a number of shots. What we have to look at is all of the factors.
Well, if we were to accept your view on this case, how in the future would the concept of finding specific intent because of the method used, here one bullet, from implied malice, which is simply a conscious disregard for life? Here, as I see these facts, this defendant clearly had a conscious disregard for the baby's life, for anybody else's life. If we conclude with you that he also had the specific intent to kill the baby, how are the theories distinguished?
Well, first of all, the conscious disregard for life theory would only apply in an actual murder case as opposed to an attempted murder case.
That's right.
So it couldn't be argued in that case. With regard to attempted murder, we would have to look to this court for guidance in under the Bland opinion, gave some examples. For example, you look at the manner or means employed to commit the crime.
Well,
you look
Bland, at the court said, while directed at a primary victim, where the defendant employed a means of attack such that we can conclude he intended to ensure harm to the primary victim, he intended to ensure harm to the primary victim by harming everyone in the victim's vicinity. And the examples that have been given from the bench relate to matters like a grenade or a barrage of bullets with no concern for the well-being of other people, and he wants to get his primary victim. You feel this is this case?
Those examples are broader examples of this same theory. I see no difference in this case. If this court were to decide, for example, that a single bullet could not sustain two counts of attempted murder, then how could...
The court would not have to decide that in order for the defendant to prevail. The court would not have to say that a single bullet cannot manifest a specific intent to kill two victims.
Should this court need further guidance. They would have to look at all the bland factors. They would have to look at the totality of the circumstances. There would be absurd consequences if this court were to say this case is different than, as Justice Baxter pointed out, a mother holding a baby in her arms. Still, you can say, well, the baby isn't the whole length of the mother. What if he shot towards the mother's head? Then, for example, that could be very different. That could be very similar to this case because we're talking a matter of inches between them. And we also have to look at the fact that he's shooting at a moving target. And how that factors into this is that unless he's an expert marksman, which there's no testimony of that, his chances of hitting the child are even greater. And the distance from which he fired is demonstrative of his intent. You'd have to look at all those factors. You'd have to look at the zone of harm.
So is there a rule that you would have us articulate that would give guidance in future cases somewhat similar to this? Or are we going to be measuring inches? Would you tell us what rule you would have us establish?
You may respond, and then your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor. That the jury would have to look at, and courts would have to evaluate, the totality of the circumstances, the scope of the zone of harm around the victim. It's not 100 feet wide. It's within a reasonable range, objectively reasonable range. You would also have to look at the method or means employed to commit the crime. Did he use a grenade? Did he use a high-powered gun? For example, had he fired one shot from a shotgun, which has a splatter spray in the means of which it's fired, you're likely to bring in more victims in that case. That doesn't mean that a single bullet from a revolver would not also include multiple victims, depending on the proximity of the victims to each other. You'd have to look at all of the factors in the case.
Thank you, Ms. Newcomb. Your time is up. We'll hear now from Mr. Marshall by way of rebuttal.
Mr. Marshall, if I could just get a clarification on the record.
Yes, Your Honor.
Was there any contention in the trial court? As I understand it, the defense in the trial court was that your client simply did not do it.
Right, that's correct.
Okay. Was there any contention in the trial court that the baby was not in the line of fire?
I don't recall any.
And the
as I stand here.
And the exhibits that were introduced in connection with that were those all prosecution exhibits in support of its view that the baby was in the line of fire?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Yes.
I did.
Mr. Marshall, would
yes.
you agree that this case is a lot like any other case pertaining to attempted murder? It simply comes down to a resolution of whether or not there is substantial evidence to support a finding that the defendant actually intended to kill the baby when he fired that single bullet from where he was standing in the back of the car into the car, and the bullet narrowly missed the baby and narrowly missed the mother. In short, do you agree that the real issue in this case is whether there is substantial evidence of actual intent by the defendant to kill the baby?
I believe that is true, Your Honor. And these questions are always, in any close case, they're always difficult because, with a rare exception to prove the rule, we never have any kind of direct evidence of an individual's intent. And that's what makes these difficult. And one of the points I did want to make was that although, as some of the hypotheticals today illustrate, this question can be made to be very, very difficult. But I do want to emphasize that, in my view, the facts here fall clearly on the lack of sufficient evidence side of the line because of some of the things the court has emphasized.
If we would just add the words to the defendant's two statements, the day before the offense and the day of the offense, and your baby, would that pull it over the line and cause the arguments you make to fail?
I could hear that certainly the prosecution would make that argument. And the defense would make the argument probably that doesn't make any significant difference because we don't have evidence of a separate effort to kill the baby. But it would make the case more difficult, slightly at least, from the defense side. But again, we don't have that fact here.
Would it be unreasonable for the jury to conclude that in view of his animus against the mother, he did, in fact, intend to kill her baby?
The short answer is yes, Your Honor. I think that would have been unreasonable for the jury to draw that.
What better way to get back at a mother than to kill her baby?
Well, again, if the problem with that theory is that there is no evidence that there's insufficient evidence that he actually did try to kill her.
Well, he certainly had animus toward the mother. He certainly fired the weapon through the back windshield.
Correct.
Nearly hit the baby and nearly hit her. What more evidence is necessary?
Well, I think the point of some of the hypotheticals or some of the discussion we've had from the bench is that he, in terms of physics, I suppose, the bullet came relatively close to the baby, but actually it didn't nearly hit the baby. It went through the rear window and into the headrest and on through the headrest of the driver's side of the car, and it went a considerable distance above where the baby was located.
So if the defendant is not a good shot, that's a defense?
No, but we only have the facts we have, and those facts tend not to support the inference that he was trying to kill the baby. I wanted to make a couple of quick points in response to some of the questions Justice Baxter asked earlier. One of the things that was noted in the Bland opinion is that the defendant who fires the one shot certainly could be held guilty of other crimes with regard to this what was described there as the non-targeted individual. And that exactly did happen in this case. Mr. Smith was convicted of firing at an occupied vehicle, of felony of assault with a firearm, and also of a form of child abuse, 273A paren A, all three in addition to the other convictions in this case. So it's not as though he was not held culpable, and specifically with regard to the baby, on the child abuse count. Also, I do believe that if the court were to affirm here, its opinion would have to address the language of the Bland case and the seeming tension between that result in this case and what the court had to say in Bland. Because I do think an affirmance here just cannot be squared with what the court had to say in Bland. And of course, I urge the court to reassert what it said in Bland, and at least on these facts hold that the kill zone rationale is just not satisfied here, and there's only sufficient evidence for the single count of attempted murder.
And you're not using the term kill zone as describing some legal doctrine. I presume that you would agree that the term kill zone really comes down to the following. It's just getting to circumstantial evidence.
That's correct, Your Honor, with the proviso that I think it is, and it is the traditional function of courts like this, to set the outer limits of some of these things. And in that sense, it is a matter of legal doctrine, of saying, you know, this far and no farther, regardless of what a jury of 12 people might decide. But I have nothing further. I'm prepared to submit, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Marshall.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Newcomb. The matter stands submitted.